featuring a discussion of pop culture and why we think you should like what we like. You should trust us because we're librarians. I'm Anna and my pronouns are she and her.
I'm Aline and my pronouns are she and her.
Every couple of weeks, give or take, we get together with someone and chat about a pop culture topic or two, what we think and how we feel, especially that because we're ladies.
We have feelings.
We'll end the show with our current obsessions. This is episode number 108.
Yes, it's episode number 108.
Opera.
Opera with Mark Cold. Today joining us, we have internet personality, cataloging librarian, and opera fan, Mark Cold. You may know them on Twitter, at MARCCOLD. Follow them now, and we will be moving along. Hey, say hi!
Hi, it's nice to talk to you.
Great.
I love opera.
You do?
I do.
I'm glad.
I want to say before we start talking that I am not an opera expert, so I'm probably going to be like mispronouncing words or maybe getting small facts wrong. I am, however, a huge opera fan, and I love talking about my opera fandom.
This is so great. That's why we wanted you to come on the show, because we are at varying levels here. And I don't know if we know any opera experts, and I feel like people listening to this who don't know anything about opera will probably feel better if we're all like amateur opera fans and not professional opera fans.
Yeah. I would characterize my opera fandom as extremely amateur and enthusiastic.
Yeah, I'm not even a singer, really. I mean, I have a kind of a voice, but I have the sort of voice that, you know, in German operettas, there's always the lady who says, "But sir, you forget yourself. I am married a lot." And I have that kind of voice.
Perfect.
But the thing is, I'm not really that kind of person. I don't have that kind of body or personality. So I've never really sung anything, but I really love hearing other people sing beautifully. And I love hearing other people expressing emotion through song.
We were just watching Amadeus about 20 minutes ago, and Aline said that she felt like Salieri. She wasn't going to be able to produce on the level of Mozart, but she knew greatness when she saw it and heard it.
And that's how, like, I can't sing for anything. Anna has to listen to me sing all the time because I love to sing, but I don't and I shouldn't. Longtime listeners of the podcast have also heard me sing once or twice. But that was something that was brought back to me watching Amadeus again, was like, this is exactly me with regard to a lot of art.
Speaking of. Sorry.
You know, with paintings and with music and with dancing, I know enough to recognize greatness and be disappointed in my capacity to produce it.
Let's start out by talking about where we each are. I'm going to start because it won't take very long.
Okay.
One of my family's good friends was an opera singer, and I saw her perform in concert a few times, but I never saw her in opera because she was always in Europe. So my association with her is that she would bring a fresh baguette that she had baked when she came to dinner, and so I like opera as a result.
Oh, nice. Because so you associate opera with that bread smell.
Yeah. She was also the tallest woman I knew, and so I was like, it was like a goal to get tall like her.
Did you? You're tall now.
Yeah, I'm taller than her now.
Excellent.
I don't remember ever going to an opera, except I have a vague recollection of going to the theater in high school. And I live in a capital city, and we had an opera company, and it's because I remember like the super titles and thinking, that's great, I like those. I can understand what's happening now. But I don't know what opera it was. I know nothing about it. Fast forwarding to college, when I took this music appreciation class, and my mom and dad copied all the music that I was supposed to study onto cassette tapes and mailed them to me because I'm spoiled. And that way I didn't have to go to the library and listen.
And also they already owned all of the pieces of music.
And so one of the pieces, though, was the overture to The Marriage of Figaro. And even after I was done with the class, I would, like, just listen to that part of the cassette tape, and then I rewind and listen to it again. It's like Angie, who's been on the podcast, used to, like, run to Eye of the Tiger. So it's like Eye of the Tiger. You just have the overture to The Marriage of Figaro on repeat.
Okay.
Except when you had a Walkman, there wasn't a repeat function. You just had to record it over and over again on the same tape.
I have a non-mixtape where I have the same song over and over on both sides of it.
So that's the level I would have been. So mostly I am not an opera fan. I'm an Overtures of Mozart fan. But
a totally respectable way to be, I feel.
So I have a small clip of my favorite overture.
She gets teary every time it comes on, and we have it on multiple playlists.
Well, yeah, also if I'm driving when it comes on, then I'm going to go 10 miles an hour faster.
This is true. I've borne witness to this.
I have a couple of other overtures, but they'll come up organically, I'm sure.
Okay.
And so when we were talking to Robin, someone on Twitter recommended listening to The Great Courses, and so I started listening to Great Courses before our episode with Robin, and then I started listening to The Operas of Mozart Great Course, which I finished. So I know more than I know, like, weird tidbits now.
You know some awesome things that you have been sprinkling into our lives.
And then after I did Operas of Mozart, I went and listened to How to Listen to and Understand Opera.
This is good.
Which should probably be flip-flopped.
But are they both Professor Greenberg?
Yeah, they're both Robert Greenberg, who is a composer and professor. I think he's in California. And he has, like, strong opinions, like, about things like Sopranos and their diva nature and other things. But he's personable, and you can get The Great Courses at most libraries, I think, large libraries. And I think they're available in some Overdrive collections, like the Boston Public Library recently bought a bunch of them.
Yep. Your library may have some. They are expensive, so they may have been given to your library as gifts randomly, so there may not be comprehensive collections. The thing that I like about Professor Greenberg, I only listened to small portions of the great courses that you had going on when you were in your car, but I did not want to jump into the CD player and murder him, which is a very strong recommendation from me in terms of listening to a dude talk about something that he is expert in.
Point. So the only other note I have here is that there are a variety of movies that I associate with opera, and we will get to them later. So mostly I am extremely new coming, but interested in learning.
And we have a cat named Tosca, but I didn't realize when we named her that you hadn't seen Tosca.
I have no context for that.
So now we need to remedy that post-haste. I brought myself to opera. I grew up going to the occasional classical music concert with my mom and listening to classic King FM at dinner time, which I've talked about on the podcast before, and listening to the occasional simulcast performance on this radio station out of Seattle. And my mom is more of a musical theater person, which we've also talked about on the podcast before. So my first opera that I ever heard was a live performance of Tosca put on by the Seattle Opera when I was in college. And I went with a family friend because I think my parents were out of town and she wanted somebody to go with her and I was conveniently located. And I was lost. It was amazing and wonderful and spectacular, and it had all of the things that I loved. It had doom love, it had a strong woman, it had tragedy. I mean, bear in mind, I was 20 years old, and, you know, a friend from when I had grown up had killed himself in the last year, and so I was at that, and I dyed all my clothes black, and so I was just at that place where many young people spend some time, and some of us come out of it, and some of us stay there a very long time. And cut to postgraduate school, going when I was a baby librarian in New York City, I had no extra money and I didn't take advantage of the cultural opportunities in that city except for subscribing to the city opera for 2 years, where you got to pick from the catalog. You didn't have to go to all of them. And I was like, okay, I can scrape together the money for three operas. It's $50 a ticket. I can make this work. And so I did, over 2 years, I saw six operas at City Opera, which is like, I'm going to the Met, and you walk up to Lincoln Center, and then you make a hard right and go into this theater that is not the Metropolitan Opera. But I saw productions of La Boheme and Madame Butterfly and others that I can't remember, but I know I have the ticket stubs for. And I loved them. I went by myself. I didn't try to get a friend to go with me. When I was with someone, they were not interested, and I continued to go by myself. And it sort of cemented it in me as a thing that I loved, that I like found by myself and did by myself. And then cut to 10 years later, when I was back in Seattle and my mom was back in the region, she and I started subscribing to the Seattle Opera, and we would go to three or four operas every year for 6 or 8 years at least. And we mostly stuck to what I will call classic operas that I don't have a true definition for, but we're very devoted
traditionalist.
To thing, very traditionalist, and I'm going to talk about the classist, racist nonsense going on there, but, you know, we're very sort of 1900, Verdi, Puccini kind of action. And we, every time we would see something modern or in German or in English, we'd be like, and then we would go on. So, tell us, Mark, about your personal opera history.
Well, I didn't really come from a classical music loving background. My maternal grandfather was Welsh, and he was sort of that stereotype of a Welshman who loves to sing, especially in choruses. And he had this wonderful bass voice. So for some reason, every time I hear the aria La Vendetta in The Marriage of Figaro, I think of him.
We have a clip.
Okay.
We do. That is this one.
Yeah, I think of that not because he was a particularly vindictive person, like he didn't live up to the word aria, but it's just because the aria is just wonderful because it, you know, it has both these very sustained phrases and these parts in it that are almost patter. So it really like shows off how beautiful a bass voice can be. Like every time I listen to it, I'm like, you know, Rosina, what are you doing? Why didn't you marry him? I listen to that aria, I think of my grandfather, and he did play some opera in the background. He didn't go to opera. He was a coal miner, didn't really have the funds, but he did love listening to it on the radio and later listening to the Metropolitan Opera broadcasts. So as I was growing up, I didn't really get a lot of that from my parents, who were very much not into that, but I did listen to the Met broadcasts, which were a huge deal for me. I used to listen to them every Saturday. And I would take those books on, you know, the great opera stories out of the library.
Yes.
You know, the ones that began the list of all the roles and the voice type that plays each role and the story. And I would read those and I would fantasize about playing the different parts because I was a very dramatic child who wasn't really allowed to act very dramatic. So this was sort of I had this secret Isolde personality within myself. And I think the first opera I went to was probably the Barber of Seville when I was in high school. A group of our high school class went because one of my classmates had a father who was a baritone at the Metropolitan Opera, and he was able to wangle us tickets.
Sweet. Wow.
And so I still remember going into the Metropolitan Opera and going into the Metropolitan Opera gift shop, which was just the most fabulous place I had ever seen in my entire life, and picking up the opera news magazines. I think I bought like a stack of them. And then I would go through the opera news magazines and I would make notes about the singers I wanted to hear. And I know this is the most ridiculous catalogery thing ever. I literally made a file for myself with all these singers' names
this
who
is
I wanted
great.
To hear. Everyone who got praised in opera news. And I don't think I really realized how odd and creepy that was until I I was watching a Law and Order episode where a woman had died and the cops were going through and they found a notebook with all these random names in them, and they began calling up all the people in the notebook because they didn't know why she had this notebook with the random names, and they wanted to figure out whether any of these people had anything to do with her death. And I realized that if I were murdered, all of these opera singers in my legal pad file were going to get called, and they were all going to be totally baffled and confused and sort of be annoyed with me posthumously. And I was the sort of teenager where that actually had a major effect on me. So I stopped keeping my own personal creepy opera authority file. Although every time I see someone or hear someone on the radio who belonged to my creepy opera authority file, I feel a sense of possessiveness.
You know.
When Thomas Allen retired, I was like, Thomas Allen, you were the first one. So my introduction to opera, it was both a way for me to express like deep emotions, and it was also a way for me to make lists of things.
These are both good things.
We love lists and obsessiveness and fandom. We're here for all of this.
Side note, there is a strong opera subcategory of mystery I learned when I was researching opera in things.
Right.
So I'm sure someone in murdered in the opera mysteries has lists of opera singers.
Yeah. So what do you do now to pursue your opera?
I have about 15,000 compact discs. I'm exaggerating slightly, but I'm not actually exaggerating that much.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm a big CD listener, and I read a lot of opera history whenever I can. And it's fascinating because opera historians are so opinionated and emotional. You know, it's not just that the one soprano is better than the other soprano. It's that the one soprano is divine and the other soprano is dreadful.
And morally compromised because she's dreadful.
Slept with every conductor on the roster. So, you know, it's, you know, this whole sort of strange gossipy world. But sometimes you read things from opera history that really make you happy. Like, I think the story I like to tell people who don't understand why anyone would like opera or why opera was sort of a revolutionary thing in back when European opera first really got started with Gluck, is that one of Gluck's first really successful operas was Iphigenie en Tauride. And there's a scene where Orestes, he's killed Clytemnestra, his mother, and he and his friend have been shipwrecked on this island. And he sings to himself about how, despite all the weird things that have happened in his life, you know, killing his mother and being shipwrecked and being in jail now, he is in fact totally chill. And he sings this aria called Le Calme Rentre en mon, dans mon Coeur. And, you know, and he's singing, and the whole aria is him like singing over and over again, calm has returned to my heart. And meanwhile, in the violins, in the string section, you can hear they're playing this figuration that's very like non-calm. And the story I love about how when they were first rehearsing this opera, the first time they ran through this aria, Orestes is up on the stage singing, calm has returned to my heart. And, you know, the violins are playing this. And the violins actually stopped playing because they figured they had the wrong music. Their music was so uncalm. And Gluck, the composer, came from the back and yelled at the violins, he's lying. He killed his mother. He's in prison. Keep playing. And I just love that story about how it was like the beginning of sort of conscious musical irony always gets me in operas.
We have a clip. It was a short one. I love stories like that. There's a gentleman in the Seattle area who is an opera scholar who presents library programs. So coordinated with each season of the Seattle Opera, he takes the operas that are being performed, and he composes a program, and he goes around to several libraries and has Norm Hollingshead's opera previews. And I only had the opportunity to attend one of them, but of course I prioritized Tosca. And he has stories like the one you just told about Gluck, about historic performances and historic performers, and the premiere production, and the time that the soprano fell off the ladder, and all of these, or the time that her wig fell off and she kept singing. And he has all of these stories, and he brings that sort of backstage energy and gossip to life, along with this really deep-rooted reverence. He's not making fun of any of these things. He loves the medium, and he loves the performers and the pieces. And it was such an experience for me to listen to him talk about something that I loved already and made me want to hear him talk about everything. I don't know if he's written or if he has recorded his lectures, but if I can find anything on the internet, I will put it in the show notes.
He should be doing great courses, obviously.
He really should be doing great courses.
I also used to love how in the Met broadcast, they used to have Boris Goldovsky, the conductor. Whenever they were doing The Ring at the Met, Boris Goldovsky would have like these interludes in between the acts where he would play the different leitmotifs on the piano and explain them. And he was really like not shy about, you know, like calling out the anti-Semitism, or, you know, just calling out Wagner for, you know, treating certain characters badly. And he was just so wonderful at explaining how all the leitmotifs sort of stacked on top of each other like Legos. Nice. To form these complex musical forms.
It's nice to have someone explain things to you.
It really is. And your mention of the Met broadcasts makes me think of the Fathom Events Metropolitan Opera in Movie Theater presentations that they've done. Have you attended any of those, Mark?
I have. They don't come up to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan where I live, but I've definitely been to see them when I'm visiting people on the East Coast.
Yeah.
I love those. I love the fact that I can see opera singers up close in a multiplex. I mean, just, it makes my little heart happy.
Well, and the productions are just so well done where, you know, during the intermission, you're backstage seeing all this amazing stuff. My mom and I went to see Tosca, of course,
recurring theme,
at the movie theater in her small town. So they do them in cineplexes in cities and on the East Coast. But the best thing about the West Coast is that it starts at 10 in the morning. And then you are out by like 2 in the afternoon, and you've had this amazing experience. I am a morning person, and so this is ideal, where every time I look at the Fathom Events calendar, now that I live in the Eastern time zone, I think that would be really great, but I don't want to spend 2 to 6 p.m. at a movie theater.
I still want to do it sometime.
We will do it sometime. We'll find something that would be entertaining. If they did Magic Flute, we could take Little G, something really, really rollicking.
And the Met production of the Magic Flute right now with the giant puppets is really nice.
There is a video version, a filmed version of the Magic Flute that my stepmother has been encouraging us to watch.
Oh, right. To watch with Little G.
Yeah.
Yeah. We should do that because the music is a lot of fun.
Is it the Ingmar Bergman one?
I don't think so. I think it's modern. I will look it up.
It would be cool if it was Ingmar Bergman. Did we answer that question?
Our history question?
Of getting ourselves, our history of opera. Did you have more to add, Mark?
I think I told all my history.
Okay.
So let's talk, you can talk about your favorites.
Oh, yeah. You talk about your favorites first.
All right. Well, I guess I'll talk about my favorites and also about operas I wish got put on more often.
Sure. Yeah.
I love all the Mozart operas. I do love all the Italian war horses, you know, all the Verdi and the Puccini, and it really does hit something in me. Like, it's hard for me even to explain, but something about being in the audience and being in a group of people who are all so emotionally involved in the life of this one character. And having, you know, not just the singer performing this for us, but also having this giant orchestra all helping her out, or him out, or them out, and supporting them as they push that sound at us. It's like it's this whole group of people who are all working together to bring these intense emotions to light. So talking about Tosca, one of my favorite opera movies is a film called Tosca's Kiss, which is about this retirement home for indigent singers in Milan. And they still sing. And one of the women who appears most in the movie is a soprano who wasn't really well known, I think, at the time. Her name was Sara Scuderi. And one of my all-time favorite recordings is her singing Donde Lieto Usci from La Boheme.
We have a clip. That's nice.
It's this intense emotion she has as she's breaking up with this guy. You know, it's just, it's not working between them. And they're trying to be really adult about it and like not have a fight, but just sort of, they've been living together, so they need to split up all their belongings. And she's saying to him, all right, I will move out tomorrow and I'll take this. And, you know, I'll ask the janitor to hang on to this for me and to send it on later. And you can keep this gift you bought me if you want and keep it in memory of me because I really did like living with you. And no matter how many times I have heard this, even if I hear it 15 times in a row, I always end the aria in this small, very sad puddle.
But in a good way?
Good way, yes. I'm a happy puddle.
Okay.
A pond, if you will, because so much of me has been taken out and I've felt so much. And it makes me so happy. Another recording that always really gets me, another opera I love, even though the plot is so bonkers, is by Verdi, which just has, you know, it's one of those Verdi operas where everyone is pretending to be someone else and everyone has a double identity. And no one is ever quite clear who knows what. So they're all fighting. And there's a lot of racism against Roma people. And, you know, so it's one of those sort of classic Verdi operas. But if I could go back, I think there was a question on Twitter once. If you go to any date and time, where would you go? Which day would you pick? And I think I picked that day in January of 1961 when Leontine Price and Franco Corelli made their debuts on the same night playing in Il Trovatore, and they sang the Miserere together.
We have a clip.
What? Amazing. We're so prepared. The crackle is the 1961, I presume.
Yeah.
I thought it might have been my jaw cracking as I opened my mouth.
That was actually them being taped live. And if you hear it at the end, you can just hear it, like, because they were both two of the most fabulous singers ever. And you could just hear the audience scream excitedly for, like, oh, I don't know, like 10 minutes or so after they finish. And you can hear, like, all of the applause and it, just listening to it makes me happy. And I can't imagine what it would be like to be in a group of people that were all that excited about something. I think, you know, the equivalent might be, you know, some religious events and some sporting events. Where
I was going to say, it's like when someone gets their first major league hit.
Yeah, we just saw that at
a baseball game
the other night. Somebody had just got called up from the minors and he got a base hit on his very first major league at bat and I went bananas.
True. However, it was the other team, so the Red Sox crowd was like, yeah, okay, whatever.
Yeah. So, but apart from that, I was listening to that piece when Leontine Price comes in and, you know, she's got this like amazing voice. And it put me in mind of the things that people who don't like opera complain about. And I'm going to oversimplify here. I don't want to discuss it. Don't at me. But when people are like, it's just all melodrama and they're just shrieking and then somebody dies. And I'm like, this is why I love it. This is what I'm here for. I want these overwrought emotions and I want everyone to be feeling everything is a life or death situation every minute for the interval of time that I am immersed in this piece of art. I don't want to live that way. It's too stressful for me, but I just love all of it. It makes me think about like all just the fanfares at the beginnings of things and the singing the same phrase over and over and over because you really, really mean it.
I mean, even the Marx Brothers felt that way. If you watch A Night at the Opera, which has, you know, it's a movie that's, you know, making fun of opera in places, but it also has a ton of opera in it.
Yep.
It actually ends with the Miserere with Alan Jones and Kitty Carlisle singing it. The last shot is Groucho, Harpo, and Chico all listening. So, you know, it really does, I think, speak to people. I think we do have a need for melodrama, or at least maybe I'm overgeneralizing. I do, definitely. The operas that I wish were put on more often, it really, like, not a lot of operas by women and by people. The Met has done, to my knowledge, two operas by white women and none by any composer or librettist of color.
Oh, for crying out loud.
The only major production of an opera by a Black composer I can think of, it was Scott Joplin's Treemonisha, which was done at the Houston Grand Opera about 15 years ago. But these are not good statistics.
They are not.
So I would love to hear more operas with female composers and female librettists, especially women of color. I think my fantasy duo bill, I'm a bit of a goth. So I would love to hear Julia Perry, who was a Black woman composer, whose work has just been terribly under-recorded, although you can hear her Stabat Mater on YouTube if you look for it. She wrote a one-act version of Edgar Allan Poe's The Cask of Amontillado.
Nice.
And given the amount of menace she managed to work into the darker portions of her Stabat Mater, I would love to hear that opera beyond anything. And I would also love to hear Wuthering Heights, which was an opera composed by Bernard Herrmann, who wrote a lot of Hitchcock scores.
Yeah.
The libretto was written by his then wife, Lucille Fletcher, who was a radio author. She wrote a lot for suspense, and she wrote some of, I think, their best scripts. She wrote the Hitchhiker story that later inspired an episode of The Twilight Zone. So the two of them together wrote a really goth The Wuthering Heights opera, which I'm sure was made even more dramatic by the fact that while they were writing it together, he left her for her sister.
That was not covered when we learned about him at movie night at the symphony.
No.
And that opera just doesn't get done a lot. I think I've heard it once or twice, but it's not frequently performed.
We have a clip of that. It is in English.
Yes. I am looking forward this summer. I'm going to get to go to the Glimmerglass Festival, which I'm really happy about. I try and visit there every once in a while. And they're going to be doing an opera called Blue, which has a score by Janine Tesori, who wrote the musical Fun Home.
Yay! Oh,
okay. We are familiar.
And a libretto by Tazewell Thompson, who's a Black male playwright and director who wrote the libretto and will also be directing the opera. So I'm really looking forward to hearing that opera. It's called Blue.
That sounds great.
I think it's a co-production with Washington, D.C., I should say, and Chicago. So it will probably also be going around the country. So I'm looking forward to hearing that. Another opera that I would love to hear in the United States is one that I actually saw in Moscow. It's an opera called Rosenthal's Children. The librettist was a Russian author who is he's very controversial. He wrote a book called Blue Lard, which has a scene in which Stalin and Khrushchev have sex with each other. And so he was sort of
fanfic.
Not Yeah, he was sort of not favored by the authorities because of that. And so when he wrote the libretto for this opera, there were actually protests outside the Bolshoi Theater. So I have ever literally had to walk through a protest of people screaming abuse at me, you know, screaming, this is pornographic, to go to see this opera. But the funny thing is that the opera is actually about asexual reproduction. It's about cloning.
Great.
The story features this brilliant German Jewish scientist named Dr. Rosenthal, who gets rescued by the Red Army, and they bring him back to Moscow, where they tell him to clone like successful workers, Stakhanovites. And he does that, but also because he loves music so much, he also clones Mozart, Beethoven, Wagner, Tchaikovsky, and Mussorgsky.
Excellent.
Music for him.
And do they all live together and have lots of sex?
No, although Tchaikovsky wants to.
Right. Of course he does. Yay!
But what happens is that when Rosenthal dies and the Soviet Union falls apart, you know, these five composers are sort of left on their own in the new Russia. And because it's about five different composers, like the opera's composer, Leonid Desyatnikov, he sort of writes music in their styles, like they each get a scene.
That's awesome.
That's like my favorite segments of Whose Line Is It Anyway?
There's something where Tchaikovsky is like talking to their nurse, and it's sort of a parody of a similar scene in his opera, Yevgeny Onegin, because he's getting, you know, because he was so into the character of Tatiana, and this time he's getting to sort of play the role of Tatiana and sing to her about, you know, how much he's always loved her, and he feels like she doesn't love him as much anymore since they cloned Mozart, that she prefers Mozart to him. So much. So yeah, Rosenthal's Children, I would love it if that would get put on in the United States.
I have a clip.
What? That would be cool. I mean, would you think it would be put on in Russian, or would it have to be Americanified?
I think people are more tolerant of operas in other languages, at least for me, because I know there are some great opera companies that translate everything into English, like the English National Opera in the UK. For me, hearing stuff in the original language is part of the charm, but I realize that for other people, it's a barrier. So I'm very conflicted about that question of whether you should perform opera in translation or not.
I need there to be super titles regardless of the language. So singing it in English does not make it accessible to my ear. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate that singing in English makes it accessible to or appealing to a larger audience. I am not disagreeing with that at all. But when I saw an opera performed in English, I saw The Magic Flute performed in English once. And I didn't like it at all because I couldn't understand what they were singing in English, and there were no super titles because I was assumed to be able to understand.
I do really love the English National Opera's recording they did of The Ring in the 1970s, because The Ring is already so complicated. So it's already presenting so many challenges to you in so many different ways that not having the language barrier sort of does help. It removes one of those. And it also helps that German and English, when they're sung, they have very similar rhythms, even if they don't have similar rhythms when they're spoken.
Yeah.
So even if you don't rhyme or anything, German translating to English still tends to sound like something someone would have written in English, as opposed to being so obviously a translation, which a lot of operas translated from the Italian tend to sound like.
Yes. Aileen has studied Italian, and we will get to this momentarily, but we were watching an opera in Italian, and she was saying that she was getting a little bit of it, but...
I need the subtitles, but I understand enough Italian to be able to, like, place myself in the statement. So you read the super title, and you watch what's going on, and you hear them singing, but you know, like, what part they're saying, or there's, like, some minor comprehension Just like when you watch a French movie with subtitles, you still read the subtitles, but there are parts of French that you can follow. Yeah.
Yes. I don't mind it when subtitles are sort of like the tone of the subtitles is changed to match the tone of the production. But it does bother me when the subtitles are saying something completely different.
Right.
Like after a singing. Like I saw a production of Pagliacci, and there's a point where one of the characters says to the woman, basically a literal translation of the Italian would be, "I've caught you, you slut," because he's found her out, like, cheating on her husband. And the English subtitle was something like, "Ah, now my game has begun." And I thought, no, that doesn't work.
No. Just,
I understand you not wanting to have the word slut in your subtitle, but that's just way too disinterested for this character at this particular moment. Like, he is not happy. He is not thinking abstractly.
Yeah.
But something like the Don Giovanni production that Peter Sellers did, that was sort of set in this really poor neighborhood where they update the subtitles to sort of how people would phrase things. To me, that works fine. And it's actually better than having just these really sort of stilted, stagey, bad Ibsen translation subtitles.
Before we get on to the Peter Sellers Don Giovanni, which we watched in preparation for this episode, I want to just cover very briefly my favorite pieces. I don't know what you have your finger positioned
over.
You'll
find out.
Okay, so play this and then I'll say why it's my favorite. Is that the processional march of Aida?
You're the one that picked it.
I know.
I presume you know what it is.
Is that what it was?
Yes.
Okay, good. So that is Verdi. Mark said something about Verdi and Puccini and those classics, and then I made reference to these classics. I'm a traditionalist. I want it to be in Italian. I want there to be super titles. I really, really, really like a different interpretation, and so we'll talk about that with Don Giovanni. And I love an extraordinary, you know, set piece where they have 300 people on stage, even though there are only 5 singing roles. And the processional march in Aida is one of those. In some productions, they have elephants on stage.
Real ones?
Mm-hmm. What's next?
So predictable.
I am nothing if not predictable. So this is the Queen of the Night aria from Mozart's The Magic Flute. And that just kills me. It just kills me. My first overwrought emotional moment in a darkened theater was when I was 15 years old and my mom and I saw Cats on Broadway. And it was, you know, 20 years into the Cats run, or probably not that long because this was back in 1986, but Cats had been around a long time and everybody had seen it and everybody had seen the touring company, everybody, insert, who was interested
and
had accessibility
right.
to a theater. And I did not know the music that well. I grew up being an Andrew Lloyd Webber fan. I'm going to get to the point really soon. The woman who was singing Grisabella sang Memory, and they had her on this thing that, like, it was like a hydraulic lift that raised her into the rafters of the theater.
She's having an apotheosis moment.
I think she was being sucked into heaven instead of being sucked into hell.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm not sure, because Cats makes no sense at all, and I am not going to give it any more credit than that. But I mean, it was like floods of tears. I wasn't making noise, but I have ever since then, I have had really strong emotional responses, and I cry in theaters. Poor Anna. When we went to see Hamilton, she thought I was going to have a coronary event because I was crying so hard for the entire time.
Yeah.
But, and so that moment, but that woman's voice is extraordinary. It's definitely Andrew Lloyd Webber, you know, writing this like unreachable music, except there are amazing women who can do this. And that coloratura soprano doing that wild stuff, the first time I heard that was watching the movie Amadeus in 1984 when I was a kid. And I didn't have that I didn't have that emotional response at the time, but it's like an iconic musical phrase that has been in my head for the last 35 years.
And it's also appropriate for Mother's Day, because that is one toxic mom.
Right?
Happy Perfect. Mother's Day, everyone.
Happy so Mother's that, Day.
And then is there another one?
There is another one.
You have another one for
Are
me?
Ready?
Yes.
I'm going to make you, it's like a musical quiz where I make you guess your own choices.
I know. I just gave her these yesterday and I can't remember any of them. Carmen. I love Carmen. I love everything about Carmen. She is a hot tamale who is going to like tear the world apart. I also recommend Carmen Jones if you have not seen the movie made in English. Dorothy Dandridge plays Carmen. She was a black actress in 50s Hollywood who had a tragic end but was in this piece that's really amazing. Isn't Sidney Poitier in it with her? Yeah, I think so.
Yes, I think so.
So I love that. But I also, the thing that all three of these are, is that they are opera that you have heard in car commercials or in a passing scene in a movie or at the horse races or maybe at a baseball game as someone's walk-up music. There are
that would
these
be awesome.
Riffs that are familiar to many of us who don't have any connection with opera at all, but we heard it in a peanut butter commercial when we were a little kid or something. And that brings me to the amazing What's Opera Doc, starring Elmer Fudd and Bugs Bunny, which is, it's the only Wagner I like. I'm not real into Wagner, but I love the Wagnerian piece that they do there, and then they do the Figaro. And if you don't know this, I will link to it in the show notes. It's when Bugs Bunny is going, Figaro, 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 Figaro. And it's when Elmer Fudd is going, oh, Brunilda, you're so lovely.
Wow, your Elmer Fudd is pretty good.
It really is. And this is another thing that we might have seen after school when we were kids, that it's actual opera going on, and it's like productions, you know, Bugs Bunny is wearing a horned helmet and long yellow braids, and you are there, this is happening, and this is, it was part of my cultural upbringing. I think that a lot of people have seen some aspect of Looney Tunes in their lives, maybe more people than have seen operas.
Probably. The Carmen piece was used in the beginning of Up, you know, the scene where he's like going about his daily life.
Really? Mm-hmm. Cool.
So for my favorites, I just have more Mozart overtures.
Oh, good. Yes. Play us some more Mozart overtures.
So I've got two. I've got this one. I mean, you just had magic flute. More magic flute.
All of these make me want to drive really fast. They make me want to run up and down the stairs. They make right? me, they don't That's, make me want to fold laundry.
Right. Well, that I like, you know, I like an up-tempo mm-hmm. action. So,
yeah.
And then the other one is Così fan tutte, which when I was growing up, we had two cats and one of them had two names because my mother had named it Così and my father had named it something else. But they didn't ever agree, so they each called the cat a different thing.
Thank you for letting me name Tosca Tosca.
I'm not disagreeing. So that's what this one is. Where it starts accelerating. It's like a snowball.
Oh my god. And Mozart does this in every piece. Everything. He does it in his Requiem, for crying out loud.
That guy.
That guy.
What a guy.
You're a dork. Okay.
Yes, I am.
So that's our favorites, and in preparation for this episode, we were talking to Mark and we were saying, you know, we want to talk about opera on the episode. And do you have something that you would like us to watch so that we could like talk about a specific piece or some of the tropes in a context for ourselves? And they suggested that we watch the Peter Sellers Don Giovanni, which is available on YouTube. And if you have been furiously taking notes throughout the episode, I wish to remind you that I will post comprehensive show notes on our website so that you don't have to have gotten everything. And I will post links to YouTube recordings of most of the pieces that we have highlighted.
Side note, the Magic Flute DVD is the Julie Taymor version of the Met Magic Flute.
And that's with the puppets.
Yes.
That's the one that your stepmom available, has been suggesting.
Yeah, that's available on DVD.
And we were able to get Don Giovanni on DVD, so we watched it in bed.
Thanks, library system.
Thank you, libraries. And you started to describe it, Mark, but go ahead and tell us the setting and everything, and then we'll jump in with our fangirl squeeze.
Well, this particular production of Don Giovanni was one of three Mozart productions that Peter Sellers developed at the same time. And they're all sort of set in this large American urban area. So The Marriage of Figaro, he's set in like this really ritzy penthouse apartment.
The Trump is in Trump Tower, isn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Yes. Così fan tutte is set like in a diner in the suburbs where a lot of college students hang out. And Don Giovanni is set in like a neighborhood that has been totally abandoned by the city. And obviously, this was made in the 80s, and there are problematic things, but it's also a really fascinating way to see Don Giovanni, which is such an opera that just shows so much of human experience. And to be able to see it in a place where people have lost so much hope, but still have joy is just, it's such a wonderful experience for me, at least. If you watch it on YouTube, it's also slightly tamed. I've heard from people who saw the original production that a lot of things that are hinted at in the eventual film version were much, much more obvious in the staged version.
Really? Because there were
several, I mean, it opened with a rape and murder.
Right, and there were several drug uses that seemed to be, like, added in for spice.
Originally, during the catalog aria, and it only literally just occurred to me that I, a cataloger, picked the one opera in operatic history with the catalog aria. That was deliberate. Originally, you know, when Leporello is really sort of attacking Elvira, and this production actually cast two twin brothers as Don Giovanni and Leporello.
Yeah, they were great.
Yeah, which is an interesting choice because Don Giovanni and Leporello spend so much time each pretending to be the other that having them played by twin brothers really works. So when Leporello is sort of attacking Elvira with the catalog aria, and because he looks just like his brother, who has already like physically seduced her, it really has a lot of impact. And originally there was like a soft porn slideshow behind her because he was showing her all the like photographs that Giovanni had taken of his drugged nude victims. And apparently the television company that commissioned this was like, nah, you can't have that. And also, content warning here, the original production talked a lot about pedophilia. That is sort of hinted at in the version that was filmed and is on YouTube. So, you know, if anyone is thinking of watching it, I wanted to let you know that. But it was much more obvious in the original staged version. Like when Don Giovanni sings his beautiful aria to the window, he's singing to an underage girl. And she later shows up to lead him to hell. Spoiler alert.
Oh, yeah, we saw her, but we weren't sure who she was.
Exactly. She still appears, but she's sort of contextless.
Right.
Whereas in the original thing, it was sort of a callback to an earlier moment, and it's supposed to be sort of the spirit of literally his most evil impulses, although all his impulses are evil, really.
Yeah, he seems to have some impulse control issues.
Now that you describe that, I remember seeing it in a, for lack of a better word, straight production of Don Giovanni that I saw with the Seattle Opera. There was a young girl in that scene.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. I mean, Don Giovanni is evil. Yes.
Yes.
But this production was, I mean, I mentioned earlier that I really like a flipped setting. I saw a Macbeth in the Wild West production once that retained all of the language, but just had guns instead of swords and things. That was really good. And I really liked this sort of, it's a very dark filmed production. It's kind of, you know, production designed by the X-Files. And having these twin brothers play these flipped roles, I have always been really confused by the mistaken identity productions where they don't look anything alike. I'm like, how can you not tell? And I know that it's like the suspension of disbelief, but casting is such a big deal. I mean, seeing these two men look exactly alike and they keep exchanging identical leather jackets to trade roles, and I can't tell the difference between the leather jackets either. It reminded me of the, I keep talking about Tosca. I don't know how many times I've seen it because I love it and I don't miss it if I have an opportunity to see it. I saw a production at the Seattle Opera where Scarpia, the evil policeman guy, was played by this giant hot dude. And it changed the temper of the piece in a really interesting way, because in some productions that I've seen, so Tosca is a diva who's in love with an artist, but then the evil policeman wants her, and that's the only way that she can get her lover freed from his wrongful incarceration is to give it up to the evil policeman.
Of course.
And I've seen productions, and she kills the evil policeman, but she does not manage to avoid her lover's execution, and so she flings herself off the top of the Castle San Angelo, just, you know, because it's super uplifting. But in three or four productions I've seen, he was like a big, sweaty, evil, scary guy. And then I saw this production where he was, like, super hot, you know, it's like there is a singer, his name is Greer Grayson or something like that, and he's got, like, this long dark hair that he wears in a ponytail, and he's, like, 6'4", and he's very lean, and he's, like, swashing his buckle all over things. And I saw that, and I was like, well, that changes things. Tosca, how are you still interested in your little short tenor when you've got this? Coming back to Don Giovanni, the casting can really affect your interpretation of the work, and it can also really engage you differently, because in this production, Don Giovanni and Leporello are played by black men, and is it Zerlina who's an Asian woman?
Yes.
Zerlina's played by an Asian woman.
And
Masetto is a black man, and there are two very, very sad, downtrodden white ladies who are played by white ladies. Anna just went to get her notes.
I went to get my notes
from our viewing because she made some notes, which
not knowing. Oh, do you want to?
Can we? Well, I mean, I'm just noticing that you wrote down boob cure because there is a thing where somebody is just, you know, idly rubbing a breast and feeling better.
It's not idle. On purpose.
He's energetically rubbing a breast and it cures everything that's wrong with him. Go ahead with your.
My notes are so comprehensive. Close up on dead rat. Wild dogs, ? Aline said, has she been mauled by a panther?
Oh, right. One of the sad white ladies has three claw marks on her chest after she has been violated. And I couldn't figure out how that came out. But
so my pen stopped working. So I ceased taking notes. But before I ceased, I wrote down James Patterson did not last long. And I wrote down, love these twins. I wrote down boob cure, and I wrote down Don Ottavio equals drip.
Yes, Don Ottavio was a drip, but wait.
Ottavio equals cop, which is a very...
Right.
Very problematic thing in light of the overall racial makeup of the cast.
Yeah.
Basically have a white cop going after two black men wearing leather jackets.
The casting in that case, like, if I hadn't been able to see any of them,
mm-hmm.
I might have felt less antagonistic toward him.
Possibly.
I mean, I did bring up an internet copy of the libretto because I felt like I wasn't following enough of what was happening with the subtitles.
We didn't read a synopsis beforehand.
Well, yeah, I mean, I know the basic outlines.
Yeah, but...
But the libretto I had did not have any of Zerlina's aria that we saw, so that was interesting.
Really?
Yeah.
What was the commendatore, right? So when Mark told us to watch this, we, like, looked at the listing or something, and I was like, hey, the commendatore is played by James Patterson. That ought to be good for a joke.
There you go.
And there's your James Patterson joke. The man never stops working.
He's always on it. He even comes back from the dead.
He comes back from the dead. Yes, to write more books.
One thing I do like about this production, though, is that every time, like, this is an opera that starts with a rape. And a lot of times when you read about productions, they try and dance away from that because they don't want to begin the opera with someone being raped by a character whom you will subsequently watch for, you know, 3.5 hours. So, you know, whenever I used to have this book where famous opera singers would talk about their most famous roles, and it was divided, you know, by opera into chapters. And there's this whole chapter on Don Giovanni, and literally I think half of it was people saying she wasn't really raped at the beginning. She wanted it.
Oh, like, for it was crying out loud.
And I think that this was probably one of the first productions that showed that as like a very, she did not, you know, even just reading the libretto.
Yeah, you know, yeah, it seemed pretty clear.
This is not a consensual sexual encounter.
This is a good current issues opera, I would say, with rape and Me Too and problematic police behavior. And it would be great if, you know, a lot of those guys got pulled down into hell.
So yeah, I guess the reason I recommended the production is that it's a problematic production of a problematic opera.
Yeah.
But it's also a very interesting way of looking at it that does not involve tights.
No tights? Are you anti-tights?
Wait, no. Elvira has some interesting tights on a few different times.
I thought they were sort of more like dance skins.
Yeah.
There's definitely some cool 80s fashion going on.
That giant cross earring. That was great. So, thank you. I have not watched any operas before, and I feel like I could still continue to watch operas after that one. So, I'm going to segue us to my question for both of you, which is, you have a patron in front of you who's like, I've never watched an opera. What should I watch? Starter opera.
You want to take that first?
I would say Carmen, because Carmen just is, it's a lot of good tunes right after the other. There are at least 3 tunes in the first act that you've probably heard before, the overture and Carmen's 2 arias. And it's sort of, Carmen does have sort of this racist portrayal of the Roma, which is true in a lot of operas, which would be the one reason I might lean towards Bohème instead. But it's still what people think of when they think of opera. They think of people dancing around and riding horses and a guy jumping up onto a table to sing the Toreador song.
Right. Aline likes that one also.
Well, I think, yeah, Bohème and Carmen are good gateway operas, so to speak.
I feel like I agree very much with Carmen, for sure. And every time somebody says something about La Bohème, I'm like, just watch Rent. But I saw a very straight production of La Bohème, and I was not very patient with poor Mimi. And I think that it wasn't the right time for me if I had seen that one earlier in my life when I had more patience with starving artists. I'd have been better off. I mix this up all the time. And so I really like The Marriage of Figaro. But what's the other one that is the...
Così fan tutte?
No, I'm thinking of Pagliacci.
Okay.
I think. And
you mean the one where he says Figaro, Figaro?
Maybe.
Oh, Barber of Seville.
The Barber of Seville. Thank you. I'm thinking of The Barber of Seville. I think that, like you said, you know, Carmen Act 1 has 3 songs that you know if you have been, you know, in the world at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is a Beverly Cleary book in which Henry and Ramona are at school and someone is singing the Toreador song. And I remember this as like my intro, that was basically my introduction to opera, was the Toreador song in a Beverly Cleary book when I was 7. And I am very interested in visual icons and auditory icons. And so if it's something that was in a milk commercial when I was a kid, I am 100% here for it. So, Carmen.
Did you answer the question yet?
But The Barber of Seville, because there's also these sort of like settings that are ludicrous and fairy tale-ish and melodramatic that are inherent to opera.
If you, the listener, have other suggestions of starter operas or gateway operas, please feel free to send them to us on Twitter at bellwetherfriends, BellwetherFrends, or, you know, send us an aria and we'll hear it from here.
A passenger pigeon.
Is there an opera that, you know, the Met is going to do and you're like, oh my God, this one again? Is there like...
Madame Butterfly.
Okay.
Yes. I totally agree with that. Madame Butterfly just incorporates so many European stereotypes of Japan that it's, yeah, it, I mean, it's very tuneful. It's also like one Puccini taking his penchant for like defenseless, sad women who are okay with abuse and just ratcheting it up 1,000%.
Yeah, what else can we do to her? What else can we do to her? I'm really glad you agree with me. I wasn't, I promise I wasn't trying to pander. I was just like, I have seen Madame Butterfly and my mom has liked Madame Butterfly. You know, that's like, I think that's something that we had listened to apart from the musical theater stuff. I saw a production of it that was a pretty straight production of it. And I was like, ooh, shudder. And I still feel that way.
I realized my analogy I wanted was like covers of Hallelujah overused.
Yes, definitely overused.
Any other ones that, you know, you're like, oh, we don't need another one of these. Let's have one by a woman.
Well, I mean, that goes with a lot of them,
you know,
for sure.
Right.
And I'm ready for more lady productions. And I'm definitely ready for a large scale production that gets filmed of Treemonisha, because the Scott Joplin opera that I remember learning about and never seeing.
That sounds good.
Yeah. Do we want to do any readers or watchers advisory?
I have watchers advisory, but mostly in sense of, these are movies in which opera is a part of them, and for me, that's what makes it memorable.
Okay.
Like, way I encountered opera was by watching this movie. So the only clip of Tosca I have is, despite the number of times it's been mentioned so far, is from the James Bond movie Quantum of Solace.
Perfect.
So here we go.
I really think you people should find a better place to meet.
James Bond beeping noises.
And every time I hear this, I think about, like, I've seen Tosca several times. I know it pretty well, and there's not anything in it that I could play for Anna and have her be like, right, yeah, I've heard that before.
Let's just watch it.
And yeah, I think that I just really, really connected to this woman taking charge of her destiny.
Speaking of La Boheme, it was featured in the movie Moonstruck.
It's a beautiful dress. I don't know. It's been a long time since I've been to the opera.
So where are we sitting?
Come on.
We'll share.
They actually go to the Met.
I know, because they're in New York.
Right, so was I. I still didn't do it. I was just looking at my notes, and before we go to, like, more movie and maybe reader's advisory, I want to make a passing mention of Operetta, of Gilbert and Sullivan.
I was just having a Gilbert and Sullivan thought.
That's, like, a whole lot of fun. I feel like Gilbert and Sullivan are kind of the bridge between musical theater, if you are a Rodgers and Hammerstein fan, and opera, but also the sung-through musical that you will find with The Who's Tommy and...
Hamilton.
And the other one that I had in my head.
Yeah, you told me it out loud.
I did, and then, you're not helping
me. No, I'm not. Is Rent?
Yes, Rent. Okay. So I feel like there is something to that, and I really like the pop music aspects of sung through musical theater as it has been in the 21st century, and I'm looking forward to more of that, and I think that if you love Hamilton, you might give opera a try. I feel like I should tell the millennials this.
Okay. You asked me if this one was on the list. Pretty Woman. There is a pivotal opera scene, which is La Traviata. You see Julia Roberts' face while she's watching?
Yeah, I think she clutches her pearls.
She's like experiencing culture for the first time. Speaking of problematic.
Yeah. So I will admit that there was an allure for me about opera being classy in my little developing brain when I was younger. And I have adjusted my attitude about that because I don't think that
you've opera adjusted it to classist
is inherently classy. It is classist, but it's also, it was a form of entertainment at its height that there wasn't MTV or YouTube. There, you know, there were plays and there was popular music and music halls, but there weren't iPods.
One of the things that Dr. Greenberg talks about in the How to Listen to and Understand Opera is the history of opera. And he's talking about in Italy and then how, you know, they were just churning out opera after opera and they only had like 12 librettos and they were like, we're just gonna do another opera based on this libretto. Here we go. But just that, how that it was like the Super Bowl and everyone was going. Mm-hmm. That's what they were doing for entertainment.
And you forget how popular it was in the United States until, you know, you go to small towns and like what is now the movie theater began as the opera house, because there used to be all these touring opera companies. The Met toured until relatively recently, but there were also these sort of, you know, they would have a soprano and a tenor and a baritone and a trunk of clothes, and you know, they would go to a town and they would enlist local people to be soldiers or prisoners or Tosca's firing squad or whatever, and they would do these really sort of ramshackle shows on no money and basically tour the country on a dime. And I think that's fascinating. It's really hard for me to imagine people being that eager to see opera in the United States, but apparently that was so.
As an avid consumer of story, I am here for it because, you know, like radio shows and just the different ways that people were able to consume narrative through history is really interesting.
I wonder what the listenership is for the Met broadcasts on the radio.
I have a library patron who calls me every week to find out what's on and what time it's starting.
I mean, it seems to me that the Met figured out that they could simulcast and that they wouldn't have to go on the road anymore.
Right.
And so maybe this is a case where technology, you know, Don Giovanni's on YouTube, people can watch on their own. I like going to the symphony and like being there with other people, and even when they clap when they're not supposed to.
Ah, that drives me crazy, but yes.
But also, like, if you just want to experience something, if you want to find out if you like something, I feel like the internet can provide more access for a lot of people. They can go to the library if they don't have it at home, right?
Yeah.
So the one that I most think of when I'm thinking about movies with opera in them, mm-hmm. is it's in A Room with a View.
Oh, right.
And Helena Bonham Carter is wandering around a field, and this guy that she vaguely knows is also in the field, and he turns and he like walks through the grasses and kisses her, and there's this swelling opera music playing. I think he just kissed her.
Did she want to be kissed?
She... That's her governess or aunt or whatever.
Huh.
Telling her to come back. She ends up with him, so I think so.
Well, she has gone to Italy to experience the world with a capital E and a capital W. So, yeah.
A capital E?
Experience
the world. I was like, the... So, the two others I have are ones that kept coming up as being used in movies, TV,
over and over and over.
Over and over. And this is the first one.
I love La Donna Mobile.
From Rigoletto. Maybe that's what you were thinking of.
Maybe.
No, it's the Barbara Sue.
That was Pavarotti.
It was. And the other one, All the Time.
My very favorite thing in the world.
Valkyries?
Yes.
We'll get to the point eventually.
Yeah. I do love me some brass.
Right.
I love that piece because there are places where they refer to the Northern Lights as being the ride of the Valkyries. Like that's going on. These are riding. So every time I see the Northern Lights now, which I do frequently living in Northern Michigan, I think of that piece.
You can see the Northern Lights in the UP?
Yes. Not very well.
But they're there.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
So that one has been the Blues Brothers, the car chase at the end, the Birth of a Nation, Good Times, Florence Foster Jenkins, which we have not discussed, and nor shall we.
Mm-mm.
Apocalypse Now.
Yes, that's the one that I know it from.
And other movies with notable opera content, of course, Phantom of the Opera, various adaptations. Philadelphia apparently has an opera scene.
Oh, yeah.
I watched that once.
They're sitting in the opera crying.
And Shawshank Redemption, there is a scene with Tim kicking back and listening to Marriage of Figaro, apparently.
I also want to put in a plug for the Australian film Cozy, which is about a guy taking a job at an inpatient institution for the treatment of the mentally ill and staging Così fan tutte there.
Yes, I saw a mention of this.
Toni Collette's in it.
Speaks Italian or knows any music. It's a really interesting movie, and it's actually even funny in places.
<That's>, despite what you might think.
I also really like the Queen of the Night appearing briefly in The Fifth Element. I feel like when the alien takes the blue form.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I really like the scene in The Lost Weekend when he's at the Metropolitan Opera watching the drinking song in La Traviata, and literally all he can think about is getting back to his apartment to drink because he's an alcoholic. And so everyone is like hyper-focused on the music, and he just does not care at all because to me it's an interesting illustration of how opera can affect you even if, you know, you don't particularly care about opera.
Yeah.
I think the moral of this episode is that opera is all around you.
Yes. Opera is all around you.
Yeah. Do you have any movies that you...
There's M. Butterfly and Farewell, My Concubine. M. Butterfly was a stage production that was made into a movie, and Farewell, My Concubine is a film, and both of them are sort of the Madame Butterfly story. So is Miss Saigon.
Which you've already told me is overused. So.
Yeah, you made reference to there being like 10 librettos, and then they just kept making more operas with all of the same story, and there's a lot of that in opera. I'm looking at my notes, and I don't have very much comprehensively written down. You wrote down books and movies, though. I will put some links in the show notes because there are a couple of lists that I found on the internet that were like, here are the books for the opera obsessive or how to become obsessed with opera. And one of the things that is mentioned on all of the list is Kabe's Complete Opera Book. And I have an ex-library copy from the library that I worked at in 1996.
And so it's an up-to-date copy.
So it's super up-to-date, but it's one of those, it's basically master plots for operas, so you can look up things in the book, and it will give you a synopsis by act, it'll give you a short list of the characters, it'll show you...
Wait, couple. A girl, dark as a gypsy and live as a panther, darts across the bridge and down the steps into the square.
Who's that, do you suppose? And then it's got like little musical phrases if you can read music. And it's really cool because before Wikipedia, you might have wanted to have something like that because I am old enough to remember life before Wikipedia, so I still have this book. And so when you say, what's Don Giovanni about, I can look at this.
Yeah, that's good. Mark, could you give us a accessible opera history book or two that you can recommend?
I really like the opera books by the author Ethan Mordden. That's Mordden. He also wrote a lot of books about the Broadway musical, and he writes really entertainingly, especially about sort of the foibles of singers.
Nice.
The fiction book that I love the most about opera is actually, I think it was meant to be a series, but I read somewhere that the author died and she wrote under a pseudonym, so I can't even confirm that. But it's like this short little series. It began with a book called Death of a Baritone by Karen Sturgis. And it's about a woman who she's grown up in this very like classical music milieu. You know, her father was a conductor and her husband was a conductor, but she doesn't really have any musical longings herself. And she winds up being hired as the business manager at this opera training program where, again, they're doing Così fan tutte, which just seems to be following me around today. And it's a really funny mystery, and it has a lot more opera content than most opera mysteries tend to have.
Nice.
And she wrote a sequel called Death of a Poobah, which is about the company doing the Mikado and facing multiple protests by multiple groups who are offended by the Mikado, which I can't blame them since I myself am offended by the Mikado. So being the business manager is even more stressful than it was previously. But they're really sort of light, interesting books that talk a lot about opera, but are also, you know, well-written and have funny scenes.
That sounds good.
There was a movie called Farinelli that was about the last castrato. Ooh. Which is very opera set.
Speaking of, our friend Stephanie, who was on the podcast a couple episodes ago, wrote a book called Masks and Shadows, which is a romance between a castrato and a woman, and it's set in historical Austria, Hungary.
A little bit of a fantasy vibe going
there. Yeah, it's fantasy, and, you know, Haydn is a character, and it's very delightful. I have, on my list of books I want to read is The Queen of the Night by Alexander Chi.
Yes.
My mother was a Dorothy Dennett fan, and there's one of the Dolly Mysteries, Dolly and the Singing Bird. I only have Bel Canto by Ann Patchett on here because it makes me laugh every time I see it, because we are part of a reader's advisory group and we were doing gentle reads and one of our number decided to bring Bel Canto as their gentle read.
This was before my time.
Yes.
That's hilarious.
My understanding that it takes place in a hostage situation.
It does.
Which is not super gentle. As far as I know, the definition of gentle read does not include threat of harm.
No.
There is a Terry Pratchett called Masquerade with a K.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the books in the Kate Ross mystery series, speaking of authors who died and were not able to continue their great series, Julian Kestrel is her Regency detective, and The Devil in Music is the musical volume in the series. I have a bunch of others, most of them mysteries, but they're not ones that I'm passionate about reading.
I wanted to acknowledge the use of the word opera when describing space opera in terms of things that are heightened and overdone and melodramatic and swoony and swashbuckly, and I really like that operatic means operatic. Thank you very much, language. I was thinking about movies and books that have opera in them, and I think about having read so many Regency romances in my life, and having a box at the opera is just a natural part of the social scene in Regency romances, where people are masquerading and parading about during intermission and dipping into each other's boxes and talking and all kinds of things. That also looms large in my imagination.
Excellent.
Have we covered our opera topics adequately?
I think so. I mean, we should mention that we went to see Phantom of the Opera on Broadway last year.
Why should we mention that?
We should mention it because the thing I wanted to say about it was that we went with Angie and Little G, and we talked about it on the way home to New Jersey, and the more we talked about it, the more we analyzed it, the angrier we got at the plot of the Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah, some of the plots and the sexual relations and the politics do not hold up.
Yeah, if they ever did.
No. Also, we've been talking about European opera, but Chinese opera way antedates European opera, and that is also a fascinating genre of music.
I know nothing about Chinese opera.
We'll have to look into it.
There's an opera by Judith Weir, which is a Western opera. It's called A Night at the Chinese Opera, and the second act of it is basically an interpolation of a Chinese opera into the main plot, because the characters go to the opera.
Cool.
I like it. All right, so we seem to have come to the end. Mark, do you have a musical obsession? It can be operatic or otherwise.
My latest musical obsession really is tube and throat singing, because if you had asked me 10 years ago, can a human being sing two pitches at the same time, I would have said no, and I would have been wrong. And I love hearing people throat singing. I should actually say Mongolian throat singing, because it's also present there, because it's just fascinating to hear. And also because it proves to me that I am frequently wrong about things and that people have wild talents that I know nothing about.
Do you have, or can you send us a link to a particular piece?
I can do that.
Okay, that'd be great. And we'll add it to the musical obsessions list. Anna, do you have a musical obsession?
Oh, I have so many musical obsessions, but I was trying to figure out what they are right now.
Okay, well, my musical obsession is the Toreador song from Carmen.
Of course, well, I was going to go with Habanera, so there you go.
Oh, two Carmen selections. I love Habanera. Awesome. Mark, do you have a regular obsession that you would like to promote to our audience?
I am reading the books that won the Edgar Awards for Best Mysteries this year, and I read The Last Equation of Isaac Severi, which is really interesting, by Nova Jacobs, and I'm just starting The Widows of Malabar Hill by Sujata Mathew.
Yeah.
Really awesome. So I recommend both of those books.
I think the sequel is out too, The Sadapur Moonstone.
Yeah. So you have a second Sujata Masi to read.
Awesome.
We saw her speak and she was quite charming.
What's your regular obsession, Anna?
My regular obsession is Mother's Day, and I got a bouquet of markers.
Because, what kind of markers, Anna?
Because markers are the gifts that keep on giving, whereas flowers will wilt and die. They are Tombow acid-free, double-ended markers, and they are beautiful, and their color saturation is amazing, and I'm obsessed.
That's great. You picked out your bouquet from the display of 80 colors at the art store.
Like 100 million colors.
And made your choices, and they're beautiful, and I approve of them. So happy Mother's Day to you.
Well, thanks.
My regular obsession is Chuck Stravaganza, which I know I'm obsessed with every May at some point. But in May, here at Bellwether Friends headquarters, we get out all of our Converse sneakers and we wear a different pair every day for the month of May. And we Instagram
in parts of June
pictures a week, and we continue half into June now because we've gotten a little overboard. We Instagram them with the hashtag Chuckstravaganza, so you can find them there, and they go through to Twitter. We have several friends on the internet who join us in this endeavor, and we invite you to do so as well, everyone out there in Bellwether Friends land, and stay tuned for some really interesting additions to the thread this year.
Sparkly,
super sparkly.
Oh, did we make it to the end?
I think we've made it to the end.
Exciting. Thanks for listening. You can find us on Twitter at Bellwether Friends, BellwetherFrnds. We'll post the episode on Facebook eventually, and we'll tumble some opera stuff on Tumblr.
Ooh, we can tumble opera stuff.
You can look us up on iTunes and leave us a review. And I'm Anna, and you can find me online at Helga Grace, H-E-L-G-A-G-R-A-C-E.
I'm Aline, and you can find me on Twitter at Surly Spice, S-U-R-L-Y-S-P-I-C-E. Mark, where can we find you?
At Mark Cold, M-A-R-C-C-O-L-D.
On Twitter. Thanks. That's great. Thank you so much for joining us. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you. I enjoyed myself.
Our in and out music is not operatic, but it was provided by a librarian named Julie Jerkins. You can find her on Twitter at Hi Miss Julie, H-I-M-I-S-S-J-U-L-I-E.